Don't you love those pictures of kids in high chairs, food smeared all over their faces? We pay all our attention to the faces, not the food, but it is the food that we'll focus on in this hour. British food writer Bea Wilson considers our eating habits and how they are formed when we are very young. Her book is called First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. Bea Wilson is a historian, food writer, and author four times over. The books include Consider the Fork. BBC Radio in the United Kingdom named her Food Writer of the Year. Her work appears in publications on both sides of the Atlantic. Bea Wilson, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure enough. You say you were once on the wrong side of a divide about eating. What was the divide and what side were you on?
Yeah, so the divide is something we don't talk about that much, even though we obsessively discuss food. But it's between people who find the whole matter of eating in a fairly healthy way quite easy and straightforward, and people who find it really difficult for whatever reason, whether they're a picky eater or anorexic or bulimic. And in my case, for the best part of a decade, I had no stop button on my eating. I would describe myself as somewhere between a compulsive eater and a yo-yo dieter. And food was just a daily source of angst and guilt. And it's quite enjoyable, the eating part. That's always been fun. But then there was the regret and a feeling that I was out of control, whereas now, much to my relief and gratitude, I can honestly say meals are straightforward. They're a joy. They're fun. I love food. I look forward to it, but I don't have a problem stopping when I'm full. And I honestly never would have thought I'd have reached that point. And the book is partly an attempt to explore how does anyone change their relationship with food, whether they're a child who's stuck not enjoying any vegetables or whether they're an adult like I was, just trapped in these dysfunctional ways of relating to food.
So in your case, Bea, had you crossed that divide before you had kids, or were kids part of the catalyst for the change?
I was really lucky. I'd already crossed the divide before I had kids. And I think I think it was partly to do with I was really lucky. I met the person who became my husband. We've been married for a long time, as he's always reminding me when it's our anniversary. He'll say, 19 long years. You know, I think it's not so bad. But he ate in a completely different way from me, and for him, food wasn't an issue. And so gradually, for me, it became something different too. I think it's so much harder, as so many parents are sort of struggling with, if you've got your own food issues, and then you're trying to feed kids in a way that's somehow balanced and not out of control, and you're not trying to make them be obsessively thinking they must only eat healthy foods. But it's really difficult if you've got your own baggage, and I'm lucky that I had just about come through by the point my first child was born.
What's it like watching your kids with food?
Well, it's still really complicated. I mean, that's also what the book's about. Like, you think you've somehow got on top of your own eating, and then you have kids and you discover, as every parent knows, you think it's going to be a straightforward matter. You kind of see the plate of broccoli, you see the child, you think that that's somehow going to make its way into their mouth, and then the reality of tea time is slightly different. And another reason for writing the book was I was so struck, as any parent is who has more than one child. I have three kids, very spaced out in age. One's age 16, one's 13, one's 7. They all ate in completely different ways. And I was just fascinated to find out more about the science of why is it that some people are so omnivorous and other people are so picky and other people have these weird passions for licorice or fennel or whatever it might be. And I wanted to really unravel how much is nature and how much nurture.
All right, so let's start the mind expanding right there, because you say we do not have an instinct for what to eat?
No, and this came as a huge surprise to me. We have certain instincts. Every human being is born with an innate love of sweetness, which makes sense because milk is an incredibly sweet substance. So the basic taste things that happen on the tongue, sweet, sour, salty, and bitter, those we have innate responses to. So we're born loving sweetness and being slightly suspicious of bitterness, which makes sense because in the wild, a lot of toxins would have been bitter. But it turns out there's nothing in our physiology which tells us which specific flavors to love. There's nothing innate that says you're going to grow up and you're going to love cupcakes and you're going to be suspicious of kale. All of those specific flavors are learned. But the problem is that they're learned in such a complicated food environment from babyhood onwards. And it's really difficult because our culture is giving us so many messages that sweet foods are something wonderful and that vegetables are something we should endure. it's really difficult to unravel these messages about reward and not also to associate particular foods with love. Parents with the best intentions in the world, they're all giving their child love and food at the same time. And so it's quite difficult as an adult. I know I had this problem, not to automatically feel that when you're feeling a bit sad and depressed, that what you need is sugar. I mean, it's so easy just to meet other emotions with food.
You take note of efforts to get kids to like vegetables, like growing them at school. But what's missing from that transaction, from that education?
I think the huge thing that's missing from all of our debates about diet and food is learning how to eat. We talk so much about learning how to cook, and I absolutely agree that that's a really important skill, and I really enjoy cooking dinner every night. I'm lucky. I'm a cook. It's what I do. It's a passion. But there's a more basic skill, which is learning how to eat. We all know that Michael Pollan phrase, I think. It's really entered into the vocabulary of eat food, not too much, mostly plant. And I think that's great advice. But my big question, which my book is trying to set out to answer, is how do we make ourselves want to do it? What about the psychology? If for some people, it's really hard.
That's almost a haiku that Michael Pollan has given us. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants. But an easy mantra to remember anyway. We'll talk more about some of the things that B. Wilson discovered. And there's a long history of scientific investigation into why we like the foods we like that she details in the book First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. We'll come back and talk more with B and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. On the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the British food writer and historian B. Wilson, who's written a book about how it is that we come to like the things we like when we eat. The book is called First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. It gets into the realm of why it is that we go for the stuff we go for. It's not just taste buds. There are social constructs, too, that enter into this. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. A lot of good information in the book, some figures as well, not an overwhelming amount of these, but the percentage of the population in rich countries that is overweight is getting rather surprising still.
Yes. I mean, it's around two-thirds of the population in rich countries that are overweight or obese. And this often gets discussed in doom-laden terms, and we're right to be concerned. I mean, it is a shocking fact that diet-related ill health and disease now accounts for more deaths, more disease than any other factor in the world today, including smoking. So it's really sad. I mean, part of my book is trying to look at, you know, how is it that food, which is meant to be a remedy, a medicine, a joy, has become a kind of poison. But equally, I'd like to look at the third of the population who are not overweight or obese. What magic charm do they have that enables them somehow to inhabit the same food supply that we're all in, this world of abundance where food is pushed at you every store you go into? How are somehow some people managing to live in this world and not become obese?
I wonder,
and my answer is, sorry, you go ahead.
Your answer is what, though? I want to hear the end of what you're going
to say. My answer is that they have somehow learned the food habits and skills that protect them from the dysfunction of the food supply.
I was going to ask if it gets as simple as the original divide we talked about, that you said you were on the wrong side of, the eating is easy, eating is hard dichotomy.
Yes, I think it is as simple as that. But I think then when you look in the nuts and bolts of it, part of our problem is we think eating should be easy. We think it should be simple, something like breathing, something instinctive. And actually, it's a series of these really complex skills. And we shouldn't be too tough on ourselves if we haven't actually managed to master them, even by the time we're adults. Because so often people will say this thing of, I don't know, often people who are on the right side of the eating divide, and they've always been on the right side, so they don't see why some people have an issue with food. And they'll say, all that needs to be done is just eat less and move more. And that may well be true, but making yourself develop the preferences and habits that enable you to eat less and move more are quite tricky. And the process of learning even something that seems as basic as how to manage your own hunger, it's really complicated when you start to look into it.
And among many other scientists whose work is brought up here, David Katz at Yale, you say, points out that we're not lacking in information about food. So what do we lack?
We lack the skills and the preferences. So another big part of what I'm trying to talk about is likes and dislikes. I think we don't talk anything like enough about the things that we actually love. We so often will sort of talk despairingly about why can't we get kids to eat more vegetables? Why don't we ourselves eat our five a day of fruit and vegetables? We know that it's only a tiny segment of the population. And yet since that advice on eat more vegetables has been out there in the States, consumption of vegetables has actually declined by 3% measured in terms of calories. And that's a bigger drop than it sounds because vegetables don't actually have very many calories. So it seems that really we don't like being told what to put in our mouths, whether we're an adult or whether we're a kid. And the way that you change your diet, it's not through some rational process of thinking, okay, vegetables are packed with vitamins and minerals, I'm going to eat more of those. It's because you discover that a crunchy salad with a delicious dressing actually tastes good and it makes you feel good afterwards, and you gravitate more towards more of those foods and less towards the donuts or the greasy meatball sandwich, whatever it might be.
That sounds good, but that's the problem.
Yeah, that is the problem, yeah. And I'm not saying you want to give up all those foods. It's a slow process. It's edging yourself in that direction.
Getting to a point where you can say, I love the greasy meatball sandwich, but this week once.
Yeah, or I love the greasy meatball sandwich, but I'm going to have loads of greens with it or something, or have a smaller portion. I mean, that's one of the hardest things. I know for me, I was always quite omnivorous, although probably more omnivorous kind of when it came to French fries than when it came to green vegetables. But I had no stop button, and learning to feel that somehow you can still be eating a generous and abundant meal, even if it's a bit smaller, that's difficult.
Bea Wilson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. You thought you'd find a big scientific debate about appetites, and actually you found a lot of agreement on what?
On appetite. I mean, if you were asking about appetite as opposed to hunger, I mean, the thing about appetite is that it's a really social mechanism. But the main thing that we know about how anyone gets to like a particular food is its exposure. And I was amazed by this. I thought there was going to be a huge debate within literature about whether our tastes were hardwired or whether we'd somehow acquired them. But no, if you look into it, there's lots of debate on questions like the extent to which certain people have certain genes that mean they respond to bitter flavors differently, and that makes your food intake different. But the broad consensus that we learn our appetites for specific foods, that is not questioned, and yet we hardly talk about it like that in the general conversation about food.
So here again, I mean, taste buds do account for some of it, but a whole bunch more of it is more social constructs and what we learned as we grew.
And exposure, yeah, what we're fed as we grow. So, yeah, I'm not saying that everyone is the same when it comes to food, not at all. And for some people, there may be sort of physical reasons that make eating more difficult. For kids on the autistic spectrum, it can be a daily struggle, both for them and their parents. There are also kids who have learning difficulties, who are slow to learn language, who are also slow to eat. Some people also have different relationships with flavor based on genes. The one that seems to keep coming up when I talk about this on radio shows is cilantro. So many people just say they can't stand it, and there is a genetic reason. For some people, it physically tastes like soap, whereas for the lucky ones of us, it tastes wonderful and green and herbal, and Mexican food, therefore, is delicious. So it's not that we're all the same, but wherever we start, we're all capable of learning a variety of flavors, enough that could support health and happiness. And that's largely to do with exposure. But some of the exposure is happening before we're even born. This amazed me.
So what happens to, I mean, the diet of the mother during the gestation period is going to make a difference in what the baby's tastes become?
Exactly. There were a series of amazing experiments done by scientists called Julie Minella and Gary Beauchamp in Pennsylvania. They gave mothers in the last trimester of pregnancy a lot of carrot juice to drink, and they found that when those babies were first weaned onto solid food, they actually preferred the taste of carrot-flavored cereal. And if you imagine that process being repeated many, many times for whatever foods the mother might be eating, that's a huge amount of memory to have banked by the point you're even born. And if you then factor in that the first bites you're given in that first year of life are also going to be incredibly powerful in molding your subsequent responses to food, no wonder some of us are sort of have such a strong sense that our likes and dislikes are part of ourselves, because we have these memories, but they're buried memories. We don't remember the things that our mother ate. It's just there. It seems to be part of our intimate selves.
This might be a little off topic, but are some of the cravings that women get during pregnancy part of that, or is that more just their own hormones seeking different flavors and chemical needs?
That I don't know. I think that is more to do with mothers attempting to correct chemical imbalances, but definitely there are cases of mothers who have, because of those cravings, gravitated towards one or other food. Anecdotally, the children are then much more likely to like one or other food. But this stuff is really difficult to unravel because, we don't learn to eat in lab situations.
Bea Wilson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, British food writer and the author of the new book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. It is much more than just our taste buds, a lot more nurture than nature as well. So some of the science, I mean, the experiments have been going on for a long time now. Clara Davis, 90 years ago, did a really amazing experiment with very young children. What did she set up and what did they find in the experiment?
Yeah, this was extraordinary. She wanted to try and find out what kids' preferences would look like if they were freed from all of the usual social pressures of parents saying, I want you to eat this or not eat this. She'd never be allowed to do it today. It would be seen as unethical the way she set the experiment up. She more or less kidnapped these children. Some of them were orphans and some of them had single parents. She took babies who'd never had a single bite of solid food and put them in a hospital where their meals were overseen by a nurse whose instructions were just to sit by and not make any comment, and just if a child reached for something, she would help them eat it, but not otherwise push them. And the foods they were offered were a smorgasbord of whole unprocessed foods ranging from beef to beetroot to bone marrow to weird things like sweetbreads and also milk and various cereals. And what she found was that left to their own devices, each of the 15 kids managed to eat a diet that was completely fine. They cured themselves of various diseases like rickets. They all had enough protein. But equally, each of them had their own pattern of eating. So this confirms we are idiosyncratic about food in a natural state. But too often this experiment has been misread. A lot of American pediatricians for the 20th century looked at it and said, well, clearly there's this thing, wisdom of the body. And if we can just leave kids to their own devices, it will all come out in the wash. They'll be fine. It doesn't matter if they're fussy. But actually, this isn't how Clara Davis herself read the experiment. She recognized that what she'd done was radically restructure the food environment. And sure, if you're only offering kids whole unprocessed foods, then preferences are relatively unimportant. But as we know, that's not the food environment that we're growing up in now.
So it's got a lot to do with the preferences that we display in front of our kids and what we make available to them.
Exactly. Social conditioning when it comes to eating is hugely powerful. There was another experiment done in the 1930s by a man called Carl Duncker, and he took preschool kids, and he found that just reading them one very simple story about a mouse hero who ate this substance called hemlock could make them believe that chocolate was something they didn't like. He told them a story about hemlock, then he gave them some chocolate powder to eat and told them it was hemlock. And 67% of them then said that they didn't like it. Well, as we know in today's culture, kids are not being told you don't like chocolate. Quite the opposite. They're being bombarded with these images of godlike athletes drinking sugary beverages. And it's really difficult for us to extricate ourselves from these influences and somehow separate food out and just allow food to be food. It's always complicated.
We had a discussion several years ago with a woman who tried to bring her children up in environments where they were exposed to just healthy whole foods. And so she told the anecdote of having to drag her son away from the deli counter at the natural food store screaming, I want steamed kale. I want steamed kale.
That's really funny. And it shows the extent to which the fact that we're thinking that's extreme, it shows how hard it is to do, because we associate cake with celebration, and it's, you kind of, if you want to become part of the social world in which we live, it's really difficult to be the kid that thinks that steamed kale is a treat, because that's somehow viewed as slightly weird, which shows the extent to which we all have a problem with this.
Well, you really do force us in the book to think about the social surroundings of the foods we eat. I mean, as you point out, you know, when your face is lit up by the candles on your cake, it's a celebration. Having cake is a celebration. In fact, you get into a part where you talk about Roy Baumeister and the psychic cost of eating virtuous foods. What's he talking about there?
Yes, he did a really famous experiment where he would place subjects in a situation where there were cookies, but then force them to eat virtuous, quote-unquote, foods such as radishes instead. And he then made them do a series of tricky puzzles. And he found that the ones who'd been forced to eat the radishes gave up with the puzzles much more quickly, because it was as if the psychic cost of having to exert willpower in that way made them feel depleted. But I think the message to take from this isn't, well, we shouldn't eat radishes and clearly we're just hardwired to like cookies. It's not that at all. It's just that these boxes that we place healthy food in, where we say it's something dutiful and it can never be a pleasure, that's a big problem. There's a huge polarity in our culture between health foods and pleasurable foods. And I would argue that the only way you're going to start eating better is if you can somehow make more of the healthy foods ones that you look on with joy.
Bea Wilson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. Here's a call from Jeannie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Well, thank you. I'm thinking about when I learned to chew slower.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know this, but at the time, why it felt better. But the saliva begins the digestion. And then I think of the Asian 80% full rule.
Which is what?
It means, like, I feel full before I'm on another piece of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would gulp and get this big bloated feeling, and that was satisfaction. Now I eat 3/4, I think, because I chew slower, think about the food, appreciate it. And also the memory thing of comfort,
mm-hmm.
Chicken pot pie. I don't. That's from childhood. But I really believe I'm healthier because I've learned to enjoy eating, chewing slower,
uh-huh.
Not on purpose, because I'm really enjoying it.
Right.
I think this is a great point to make, that actually through savoring food and slowing down, you can come to eat less and enjoy it more. There was a really fascinating study done by someone called Paul Rosin when he looked at how people ate in France compared to in the States, and he found that in America, people tended to eat bigger portions than in France, but also they were wolfing it down really quickly, so they weren't getting as much pleasure from it. And just as this caller has said, if you can somehow reach the point of savoring each bite and enjoying it, you may find you're satisfied with smaller portions.
We talked to another author several years ago who talked about mindful eating and not doing distractions, you know, not reading while you eat, that sort of thing. So how much did you get into the focusing on the process of eating?
Yeah, I do talk about that a lot. I think the mindful eating makes a lot of sense, whether you're an adult or whether you're a kid. Something that amazed me was the extent to which children can actually be taught to get better at recognizing their own sensation of fullness. So up until the age of 3, amazingly, human beings just stop when they're full. It does seem to be something that's instinctive. But then the skill is lost. A 5-year-old, if you give them too large a plate of macaroni and cheese, they will eat too much. And the same goes for us as adults, unless we have somehow learnt the skill of recognizing our own internal hunger cues. And this does come back to mindful eating. And there was a study done where a pediatrician went into a preschool over a 6-week period and took these dolls in, and they had fake stomachs filled with differing amounts of salt. And the kids could put their hand on the doll's stomach and say, this one's very full, this one's half full, this one's hungry. And then they would compare it with their own stomachs. And after 6 weeks, they were starting to say things like, I think I'm full, so I'm going to stop eating now. Which is a skill that I know I only learned, well, fairly recently. I mean, these are difficult things to be able to just say, yes, I can see that there's already a lot more cookies left in the jar, but I'm actually going to stop now because I've had enough.
So ultimately, in those circumstances, it's not so much about our knowledge of the food, but our knowledge of ourselves.
Yes. I would say one of my pieces, I don't want to offer advice in the book because I have no idea what someone's personal circumstances are, but focusing more on our response to the food rather than the food itself, that would be a big thing.
The book is called First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. Bea Wilson is the British food writer and historian who wrote it and is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We get another segment to visit with her some more. So join us with your phone calls and emails if you'd like to jump in and talk about how we developed our eating habits. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Bea Wilson and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Bea Wilson, the British food writer. Her latest book is called First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. And it explores the fact that it may, in fact, be a whole lot more nature, or nurture, rather, than nature that determines why it is we like the things we like because of our training when we were kids about what we took in. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You get to an example of what seems to be the king of the hill of foods people don't like, Brussels sprouts.
Mm.
Wow. Any idea why?
I think this is mainly to do with the way in which they're offered. It's partly a lot of kids have memories of being forced to eat Brussels sprouts. I know in Britain they're so strongly associated with Christmas Day. You have to have them there with the turkey. And so many children were sort of forced to swallow down one of these bitter globes, probably overcooked and slightly sulfurous. So that's not a great start to get off to with any vegetable. There's a large literature on the question of whether some people don't like Brussels sprouts because they are these people called super tasters, which is around 25% of the population. And these are people who actually have more taste buds on their tongue. And genetically, there are certain chemicals, including those found in bitter green vegetables, which taste much stronger to them, whereas around 50% of the population, we're medium tasters. And then, weirdly, 25% of the population can't taste these bitter compounds at all. But from a mass of studies into the way that super taters actually eat, it seems that that isn't a deal breaker for liking vegetables like Brussels sprouts. It seems that super taters actually have a very similar pattern of eating vegetables to the rest of us. In other words, yes, they don't eat enough of them, but no more so than people that can't taste the bitter compounds at all. So it seems that even if you're experiencing that kind of bitter edge to a green vegetable in a stronger form, really what matters more is how you've been given it, whether you were served it in some delicious form. I mean, I say in the book that if everyone were first given a Brussels sprout kind of caramelized with lemon zest and garlic and chili, maybe it would be our favorite vegetable of them all. I love them.
I do, too. Cumin braised Brussels sprouts, one of my favorite dishes to prepare. But so how open-minded are we as a species if we decide as a kid, I can't stand that thing, and we just make the yucky face, you know, even in our 40s? Are we ever going to try them again? Do we ever go back and give things a second chance?
If we do go back and give ourselves a second chance, the amazing thing is that the human olfactory system is really malleable. We're totally capable of learning new tastes in adulthood, even in old age. The problem is that we become more resistant, and each time you say to yourself, I'm a Brussels sprout hater, it becomes part of your identity, and you're that much less likely to put it in your mouth. And even if you do put it in your mouth, the exposure only works if it's positive. And so if you're putting something in your mouth constantly thinking, yuck, yuck, I hate this Brussels sprout, I hate it, that doesn't really work. But there is a new technique which has been pioneered in feeding clinics over the past 10 years, which has certainly helped a lot of extreme picky children to get over their reluctance to try new things, which is called tiny tastes. And the thought is, I've done it with my own youngest child, who I thought would never expand his horizons. The idea is if you can reduce the new food being tasted down to the size of a pea or even as small as a grain of rice, suddenly it's possible to put it in your mouth. you don't attempt to eat a whole portion in one go. You just try that one tiny piece, and again the next day and the next day for around 10 to 14 days. And there have been lots of studies done in schools around Europe, but also feeding clinics in the States, showing this has been quite miraculous for even kids who were so resistant that they were only eating a handful of foods like grilled cheese sandwiches and were even having to be fed by a tube because they weren't getting enough calories to survive. There was a case study of two toddlers who were able to build up their repertoire to 50 or 60 new foods, which is life-changing.
And it's not just eating. I understand just licking was enough to satisfy the requirements of the tiny taste.
Yes, just licking. Regime. And that was a big thing in our house, because previously, if my son had licked something and spat it out, I wouldn't have been praising him and saying, well done, you deserve a sticker. Whereas the tiny taste thing somewhat opened my mind as well.
All right, we have a call here from Carol in McKinleyville. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bea Wilson, the author of First Bite.
Oh, hi there. I've been playing with diet for a long time. I'm in my mid-60s now, and in my early 20s, I became a vegan, influence of the Adventist church, and then it was about 10 years, and then I played with semi-vegan and different things mm-hmm. all my life. Anyway, the truth is becoming so apparent that you are what you eat, and you need to eat as if your life depended upon it, which is absolutely true. The processed foods are not only addicting, they cause all kinds of cancers and weight problems and diabetes. Everybody knows the whole list, and everybody's fighting. And what I would suggest, and what I'm trying to do myself, is grow as much as you can yourself and only eat the unprocessed fruits and vegetables. And meat now is processed meat has now been put on as diesel fumes, asbestos, and cigarettes, and it's unsustainable. It's ruining the planet. And actually, real food actually tastes really good generally to everybody if that's all they're getting. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think that the nutrient part actually tastes good, and the fresher it is, the better it tastes. And,
okay, let's get some thoughts back from B. Thanks for the thoughts, Carol. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I agree with all of that as a way to eat. I think it's a great way to be. But I think what's so sad about our current situation, and this is why we do need to talk about the psychology of it, that there are so many people who, you know, they might even be at danger of losing a limb through amputation because of diabetes, and they still are clinging on to this diet of processed foods, of sugar, of white bread, of all of those other foods. And that, to me, shows how deeply emotional eating is. You might rationally know that the kind of diet you should be eating is the one that you're advocating, and which, to me, that would be where I would get my joy too. I absolutely agree. A vegetable fresh out of the ground, there's nothing more delicious. But it takes a long time for a lot of people to get from the first state to the second state, and they're not going to get there through fear or shame or through going on yet another short-lived January diet. It's a process of really re-education of the senses. It's about rediscovering new pleasures.
There's a real aversion to some foods in their natural state. I mean, when I think about how, you know, red and shiny the apples have to be in the store, I mean, we're even talking about things that you can pick off a tree in your own yard in some cases, and a lot of people wouldn't dream of doing that.
A lot of people wouldn't, and a lot of people are just, as you say, averse to anything in its natural form. I mean, I think that does come back to the fact that cooking and eating do go hand in hand, and we have lost so many of our basic cooking skills to the point where people maybe don't even know how to peel and chop vegetables anymore and expect them to come prepackaged. And it's very strange, because when you're in the state of having tasted a really good, crisp apple from the tree, then those shiny ones, they don't look so good anymore. But there's a big problem with our food supply. I mean, I would say that the main educator of our children's palates is no longer necessarily a parent, but is the food industry, who has this interest in pushing these foods high in sugar, fat, and salt, which means that children develop a taste for them, which means they develop more of these products. It's very difficult to break the cycle, and that's why it's great that things like school food have at last started to be reformed, because that's one area of hope. In Finland, as I talk about in the book, they changed their whole system of preschool education around 10 years ago to make it centered on teaching children how to eat. And it looks as if it's had really beneficial effects of not just lowering child obesity, but also kids going home and saying to their parents, we tasted this strange new purple vegetable called beets, and I really want some, and can we buy it?
That's fun. Let's take another call here from Heidi in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Bea Wilson, the author of First Bite.
Hi, I love the conversation. My comment was that if we would just show some respect to the food that we eat, you look around and people stuff their faces in front of television or while they're driving on a lunch break. We're not showing proper respect to the food. The food industry, of course, makes a lot of money. That's all they're interested in selling their stuff. And, you know, the sweeter they make it and the saltier they make it, we all crave it, which is all so wrong. Instead of just sitting down and not drink the milk out of the carton from the refrigerator, but pour it in a glass and eat civilized. Sit down at the table together and enjoy the food that you have just prepared.
All right. Thanks for that, Heidi. Appreciate that. So, in fact, B, you say that dinner is really the most important time of the day at your house.
It is. And I think it's sad. In the disorder chapter, I talk about how when a child is recovering from anorexia, the way that you recover is the whole family focuses on refeeding that child and sitting down and having lunch and having dinner. And the rest of us who are recovering from less extreme eating problems often just don't see how important dinner is, and it often gets second billing to Instagram or email or after-school activities, whatever it might be. And a lot of people do seem to struggle just to make the time to sit down together and stop and eat and, as the caller said, show respect to the food. But once again, I would say it is very difficult for people today because our idea of what's normal has changed. A generation ago, it would have been absolutely frowned on to be walking down the street eating food. And now somehow those old taboos have broken down. And then people think it's fine because they haven't actually ever been given a model of a different way of eating.
You know, I think, too, about the appeal of the packaging. We talked about how appealing it is to eat cake because you're used to having candles and singing, and there's a party that comes with the cake, even if it's not all, if all the surroundings aren't there. But then I think about the packages and, you know, the appeal of an apple or even something like a beet on a store shelf is much less than that shiny bag with Chester Cheetos out there on the front.
Yeah, we're not getting the logos and the messages and the brand names. And, yeah, I completely remember that nostalgic appeal of sitting at the kitchen table reading the back of a cereal box. And it kind of kept you company. It was about the font. It was about the cartoon characters. It made you feel warm and fuzzy and happy. And part of our huge problem with eating is that so many of our feelings, which are good about love and family and sharing food, they're bound up with these memories of industrialized junk food. It's something that we share. It's almost like a common liturgy. We all know what a Mars bar tastes like. It's difficult to break free of our dependence on these foods without feeling you're actually losing something quite special, which might be your own childhood.
I wonder how much we make mistakes as parents, though. You'd mentioned earlier about the you know, like, oh, come on, just eat some of your vegetables. The way we make it seem like a chore when eating the other stuff on the plate is fun, or if we're messing up by doing the ooh, yummy carrots thing, you know, with the kids.
No, I think doing the ooh, yummy carrots thing, I know it sounds a bit lame, but I think that's probably better than lots of feeding techniques. I think one of our problems is that we've inherited a lot of our feeding techniques actually from an older generation who knew a lot about how to feed children in a situation of scarcity. But these techniques like clean your plate, that's a disaster in a modern food supply where the plates are so much bigger. And what that technique does is it teaches children to ignore their own cues of hunger and fullness and just think, I've got to be on a mission to just finish up whatever's there. Also, we know it doesn't really work because if you're someone who really is a picky eater or a small eater or you eat like a bird, being told to finish something is quite overwhelming and it usually backfires. It's so hard as parents. It feels like a minefield and it feels like such a source of guilt when it should be a highlight of the day. It should be a pleasure. And I think the biggest thing that parents could do, I think as we're fed these mixed messages ourselves that somehow you should be getting a certain amount of nutrients into a child, and that becomes a source of anxiety for the parent. Whereas if you could think that the end goal is really building up someone's palate to the point that when they're an adult, they go out in the world and they choose the good things freely of their own accord, that's the point you want to reach.
Well, you mentioned using the tiny tastes process on one of your own kids. So how much more did you expand his palate?
Hugely. And it's not just, I mean, we did it with a range of vegetables. We did it with eggplant. We did it with cabbage. We did it with raw red peppers. I then started doing it with other foods like omelet in tiny pieces. But it wasn't just those individual foods that he was able to add, which, you know, I was so happy that he had a few vegetables other than just carrots. And it was more the sense that he had this technique that he could use himself. And he was only 5 when we started doing it. He's now 7. And he'll now sometimes say to me things like, "Mummy, I still don't like soft-boiled eggs, but one day I will do tiny tastes and I will like them."
Wow, so he's even planning for the future of changing his palate. That's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The book is called First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. Bea Wilson, the British food writer, put it together and joined us on The Exchange today. Bea, a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the great question.